You're listening to VO Stories, episode 55. I'm your host, voiceover talent and trainer, Tina Zaremba. All right, here we are, episode 55. I'm excited for you to hear today's guest, not just because I watched him all the time when I was a little kid on TV, but because he has this expansive acting career that started in a grade school talent show, wait till you hear that story, to years later starring on Broadway, to film and TV. I'm talking with Bill Smitrovich. Like I said, when I was a kid, I watched him on TV. I knew him from the 80s show, Life Goes On. Did you ever watch it? Have you heard of it? It was one of my favorites. He played the father. So I have to say, I was a little nervous talking with someone that, you know, I used to watch as a kid on TV. But my nerves quickly dissipated, as Bill is such a down-to-earth and generous person. Listen in as he shares the power in being open and available, as well as his journey in acting, auditioning for the legendary playwright Arthur Miller, and much, much more. Here's our chat. All right, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, this afternoon. I know it's morning where you're at, so thank you.
My pleasure.
I want to ask you, when did you discover you wanted to be an actor? Was it like when you were a little kid, when you were college? What happened there?
When I was in grade school, I got involved in something, and I moved around a lot when I was a kid. So I was new to the school. I walked by this open door and I saw they were having a talent show. And I said, what do you have to do? And they said, well, we're looking for an Ed Sullivan impersonator. So I said, I can do that. But whoa, a really big shoe, you know, when I get up there and I'm in fourth grade or fifth grade or something. And it was a big hit. And in fact, at one point, my father got a chance to see me on stage because he died when I was 17. But what happened was the show was a great success. And so much so that I was out there, you know, we were having a good time. Everybody's relaxed. And I'm in front of the curtain. They actually had a curtain at the school for the school theater. And I'm in front of the curtain and someone reaches underneath the curtain and ties my shoes laces together.
Oh.
So I looked down and I saw it was going on. And I looked out at the audience and I just pretended not to see it. And it was just, you know, it just came along. I pretended not to see it. And then I said to myself, this is going to be really funny. And it was. And I played it to the hilt. And I, you know, had such a good time that other little fifth graders were coming up to me and asking for Ed Mulligan's autograph. Right? This is true.
So wait a minute. Some kid tied your shoes together?
Tied my shoelaces together while I was talking to the audience as Ed Sullivan. Or Ed Mulligan.
Oh, my God. How?
But when I took it, it was a great opportunity to be funny.
Yeah.
I took it as an opportunity, not so much these guys are trying to screw me up.
Yeah.
I took it as, man, this could be really funny, you know, because I was getting laughs all through the show, you know.
So, have you had other experiences? I have a lot of questions for you, but have you had other experiences in your career like that where it's like, shoot, this could really be, someone could look at this and go, this is going to be a mess up, but you've taken it and had it work for you?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there are plenty of times when you're just not ready for what's coming and
yeah.
You know, you're open and you're available, you know, and I just mentioned that because I was in fifth grade and it just, you know, it was sort of an instinct that I had and it came from nowhere. It just came from being the new guy in the school, which I always was, just having fun. I was having so much fun. Everyone was looking at me, which I dug, right? So I didn't do any more acting until I was in college. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, Jody Gottlieb, our friend.
Yeah.
We went to college together at University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. As I said, my dad died when I was 17. So I took a couple of years off and did some crazy stuff and then got a job at 19 working in a factory. But, you know, I just wasn't happy. You know, I moved around and then I said, well, I have to go to college. So I started going part time. And then I said, no, I have to quit my job and get a full-time, go to school full-time. So I did. And about 4 or 5 years later, it took me 6 years to graduate because I had to drop out and then come back and get a job and things of that nature. In about my, I think it was my junior year, maybe the beginning of my senior year, my fraternity brother said, well, you know, why don't you be in this play? And it was called The Investigation by Peter Weiss. And it was about the Nuremberg trials. So I was fascinated by it. You know, I read it and, you know, I didn't know much about the Nuremberg trials. So I read a little bit more about it. And it was great. You know, everybody really enjoyed it, said, hey, you were really good, blah, blah, blah. So I said, oh, okay. You know, didn't really pay much attention to it. And then someone, you know, and I loved stand-up comedians. I loved Lenny Bruce, Red Fox, Bill Cosby, George Carlin, Rusty Warren, you name it. You know, they were great. So someone came up to me and at school in University of Bridgeport and said, hey, you ought to go audition for Lenny. And I said, wow, they're doing Lenny here? Wow, cool. You know, I thought they meant Lenny Bruce because it just opened up on Broadway. So I went down to the theater and thinking I was going to get Lenny Bruce story. And it was of Mice and Men.
A little different.
So I'd never read of Mice and Men, unbelievably so. I wasn't a big reader. I was minoring in special education at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'd already tutored in some Down syndrome kids, some kids with disabilities and handicaps, and going off to these work-study programs with these young men and women who were heat-sealing packaging. And they were doing the menial tasks, but they were part of the community, right? And I was there to administrate or the shop that they had. So anyway, I get the script, and I'd never read it, as I said. So I went down the hallway and I read it, and real quiet, beautiful moments. I kept on reading it, and it was the first time I'd ever wept at a piece of literature in my life. Mm. And the thing just exploded in my head. I just, wow, this is fantastic, unbelievable, you know. So I marched right into the audition room, and I did this audition with Karen Wexeldorfer, who was the star of the theater company at the time, theater department. And we got into the barn scene with Lenny and Curly's wife, who she was playing. And in that scene, she asks Lenny to stroke her hair, and then Lenny gets a little carried away and he strokes her hair, breaks her neck and kills her. So I am in the middle of this scene in the audition and I am into it. I am so into it. And I was about halfway through and I heard someone laugh or snicker and I stopped and I looked at this guest director, Al Pia, who became my good friend after a while. I looked at Al Pia and I said, you're laughing at this? You've got a lot of nerve. You got a lot of nerve laughing at this character. This is a beautiful human being. You can't laugh at this character. And I got really defensive. I was upset. I was emotionally upset. And he said, no, we're not laughing at you. We're laughing with you because we just found our Lenny. Oh. And I was on air. You know, I didn't know what to do. But Al and Morris Karnofsky, who was a teacher there at the time, and Jody Gottlieb was sitting at that table. She was his assistant director.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that is remarkable.
Wow, yeah.
I haven't seen Jody in many, many years until we reconnected at my acting classes. And to think that someone was actually there when that moment happened is incredible after all these years. But it went on to become a wonderful production. And Al, he had a theater in Stamford, Connecticut. We took the production to his theater in Stamford. I started to work with Morris Karnofsky and Phoebe Brand, who became wonderful friends of mine, as did Al. And Al taught me so much about acting, theater, breaking down a script, how to look at a character. And the reason why I say now all art aspires to music is because of Al and why he taught us to break down a play or into beats, into mini beats, big beats, you know, so that you know what area of the script that you're in when you're there and you're concentrated on just creating and making that one beat as strong as you can and move on to the next one, move on to the next one. So I saw a book later on by Michael Chekhov, Anton Chekhov's nephew. Mm-hmm. And in the book, every chapter starts with a quote. And one of the quotes was, one of the chapters, the quote said, "All art aspires to the condition of music." And it was an English critic at the time. It was in the early 1900s. And I never forgot it. And everything I do is kind of infused with that sensibility, including voiceover. And, you know, if you look at a lot of, you know, everybody's got their different rhythms and tempos, and so do written pieces of literature.
So from that play, then was it off to the races for you?
Funny thing, I did a couple of plays, did a Moliere play there at Sterling Barn and a couple of other plays. But I knew I wanted to be an actor, but I didn't know what I was going to do. And Morris Karnofsky put me in his production of Volpone. I yearned to try to find a place. And then a friend of mine told me about a master's program at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. And I said, "Isn't that an all-women school?" He said, "No, I've been here for a year. The master's program is now co-ed, and it's the second year, and they're accepting male students." So I went up there and auditioned, and lo and behold, I got in, and they gave me a scholarship and a stipend. I studied very hard there, master's in fine art, and then I also taught at UMass Amherst for a while, and then formed my own theater company, or our own theater company, with some friends at Smith and in Northampton, Massachusetts, called the No Theater Company. We didn't have a theater, so we called ourselves No Theater in relation to Japanese No Theater, spelled differently. But we became kind of popular in Northampton. We had our own original plays, and we had this one original play called The Elephant Man. But this was not Bernard Pomerantz's Elephant Man. This was before he had written the play. We took our play, and we brought it to New York. We went to the Performance Garage, or the Wooster Group, as it's known now, on Wooster Street. And those were the days of Richard Schechner and Spalding Gray and Willem Dafoe and Liz LeCompte. And so we took our little play down there in the summer, and I just said to myself, well, I'll give it 10 years. And if nothing happens in 10 years, I'll either go back to school or I'll go back to the restaurant business.
So what did you do during that 10 years to survive? Were you doing theater and then like waiting tables?
Yeah, I worked a lot in restaurants. And then I got a commercial agent. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, I started studying with Jack Garfine. And I started to book some commercials, which allowed me to go out of town and do regional theater and have a little cash coming in. As I started to study with Jack Garfine, he was also producing an Arthur Miller play called The American Clock.
And The reading I did on you, that was like a sink or swim situation.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Long story short, we were in the class. Dana Delaney was a member of the class. And Jack invited Dana and I to audition for Arthur Miller and Dan Sullivan for the production.
What was that audition like? I mean, did you realize who Arthur Miller was?
Oh my God. He was my hero. And Jesus. Dan Sullivan, I certainly knew who he was because of his reputation in theater and Seattle Rep and Broadway. But Arthur, he's my hero. I mean, he would always been my hero. He writes characters for me. I'm the American everyman, you know, and or I assume I am. Went to the audition. The audition was, they read me for the lead. And I went, oh my God, I'm reading for the lead in an Arthur Miller, new Arthur Miller play. So I studied and went in, and they hired me. But not as the lead. They hired me as an understudy and assistant stage manager. But I understudied 15 different male roles and seven different actors. Wow. So there were more roles than that, actually. But so I knew the script like the back of my hand. I went to every rehearsal. I was assistant stage manager. I was a gopher. I did everything I could. But I knew those words. I said, if anything happens, I'm going to be ready. Well, sure enough, the lead actor, Peter Evans, who fell ill and went on opening night with 104 temperature and couldn't go on for the second, third, and fourth performances, which was there's a matinee and evening performance the next day, and then another evening performance. Well, Peter was coming down with AIDS, and no one knew it. Mm. He was just sick, and it was just the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. Mm. No one knew. So the tragic thing was that Peter couldn't go on to Broadway as we did, and he died shortly thereafter. That performance, when I went on, Dan Sullivan and I went through the blocking in the hallway of the theater because he left. He had to leave. Arthur Miller had to leave. So everyone, I was just left there with the stage manager and my cast to help me through this situation. And boy, did they help me. And we ended the show, standing ovations every night. I got a great write-up. The people from the River Cafe, or Buzzy O'Keefe, who was the owner of the River Cafe, called me and said, listen, you know, I think I'm going to have to let you go because, you know, you're out of town a lot. And I said, you know, it's okay. I've got a job now.
That is great. It sounds like from the story you told me when you were in fifth grade and you were in that talent show, the story right now with the Arthur Miller play, it feels like you have a strong sense of self. Is that accurate?
Like, I'd say so.
Where did that derive from? Because I feel a lot of people that are actors, including myself at time, can be mired in self-doubt. Where did that come from? Is that like just who you are? Did your parents say something to you? Or is it just how you are with the work?
That's an interesting question. But I will attribute it, part of it, to the fact that throughout my years in this business and meeting countless people that are actors and in the business, primarily actors, there's a lot of us that have moved around a lot when we were kids. Look around, you know, you'll ask people. I would say maybe one out of four people I've talked to have either had a military background life or moved around a lot. I think that had a lot to do with my sense of self. You know, I was nervous a lot, always looking around, kind of like, you know, trying to see, checking out the society that I was in to see who was going to be my friend, or, you know, like looking, listening, lots of observation, trying to make friends, being personable, you know, but strong, mm-hmm. because there were times that I would be tested in a school. I went to three different high schools, two different junior high schools. I went to four different grammar schools. So there is a, I guess that's inherent in the life of a kid who has to move around. That's a sink or swim kind of moment right there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have time for doubt. You don't have time for self-doubt. I sometimes envy kids who have been in the same school all through their life. But then again, I think, geez, I also envy people that have had their parents for most of their life. Mm. Well, there's a freedom. There's a freedom that comes with that. When you're free of your parents and what their influence on you, the negative influence might be as an actor, that's gone. I no longer have to please my parents. I don't please my parents. I see this sometimes. People get so homey, so into their own little comfort thing that they find it hard to see outside of that comfort zone. I like being outside of my comfort zone. Some people don't. I think that's a part of why I am who I am. I'm not afraid to take a chance. After my dad died, I ran into a buddy of mine from California, and I was 18, 19 years old. He said, you want to go cross country? And I said, you bet. Let's go. We hustled our way across country, bowling and shooting pool. And for about 2 weeks, Ford Fairlane, and I sold my car. I had couple thousand dollars in cash that we had. I was going to move there. I was 19. I said, I'm going back to California. He had a 45-player, Tina, that we installed underneath the dashboard, underneath his radio. And it was a 45-player on springs so that when you went over a bump, the record wouldn't skip. And put 10 45s on this player. And we had a box of 45s in the back seat of the car. We'd reach over and grab a handful of 45s and throw them on the spool. And there you go. We'd be flying down the highway, you know, with 45s playing, the Shirelles, the rock, you know, I mean, come on. It was a great, great experience, a great adventure. And then I went back to the theater and did Frankie and Johnny and the Claire de Lune off Broadway.
I love that.
Oh, well, Caroline, Aaron, and I just burned that play down. We just loved it. During the run of that, I get a script called Glenbrook, and it's a family with a Down syndrome kid. I get emotional just thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I read the script and I just fell in love with it. It was just, man, what it was like.
It was kismet for you, man.
From heaven, you know.
And looking at that you were minoring in special education you had worked with kids that had Down syndrome. I mean, seriously, the stars aligned.
Oh, yeah. It was
that's beautiful.
Matrix times 10. And so, you know, I was reading and we went in and read, and Patty LuPone and I auditioned together on a soundstage of a soap opera. And they gave us about two or three scenes to do. We did it. We both knew our lines. It was just like butter. And both of us, you know, it was great. It was one of the best auditions I've ever had with another partner, in that we just kind of fell into it. And
Let me ask you, when you have those auditions that you fall into it and you're in that zone, do you leave there hoping you've gotten the job, or is it like...
I left there walking on air, knowing that I did an incredible audition.
And it was
going to
be
whether I got it or not, I felt great.
That's awesome. And I think that's something to aspire to for people in this industry, whether they're actors, voiceover actors, to be about doing your very best and putting it all out there.
Oh, yeah. That's the job, Tina. Right there. That's the job. The rest of it is fun. And measure your successes and your failures based on what you put into it.
Yeah.
Into the work, not whether you got it or not, but what you put into it. And if you feel good putting in, because it's not always the best actor that gets the role. It's the right actor that gets the role.
And it's so subjective too sometimes.
Oh, totally. Totally.
So let me ask, in addition to having the career that you've had, you also do teaching and teach other actors. Do you focus a lot on the beat work with them?
Well, when we get to a scene that's actually been written and, you know, it has a value, it will have beats in it, and we'll look at it and we'll read it over a few times and we'll find where they are. That is just, you know, it doesn't start right away. Mm-hmm. You have to get into the script a little bit. You have to find your natural beats. And if they're aligned with what the copy is, what the words are saying. You can find your own natural rhythm and it could feel real good, but it might have nothing to do with what you're reading off the page. So the trick is to balance and just to stay relaxed throughout all this and just in your head. Just, you know, you have to analyze as you perform, which is not something that I would recommend for everybody. But in the voiceover world, when you look at a piece of copy, you're almost doing... what you're doing is you're analyzing while you're performing a lot of times. And that analysis is picked up in your voice, I think. And you can't analyze and perform at the same time. It's very, very difficult. And this is what I teach my students, is the inner game of acting. That's the name of my class. And self one, self two is an aspect of the inner game of acting. Now, all self one and self two is the left brain and the right brain. Our brain is broken down into two lobes, the left lobe and the right lobe. The left lobe does all the analyzing. The right lobe is more about feelings and texture and atmosphere and things of that nature, you know, touching and you know, just it's all visual. That's what you need to get out of your left brain. You have to get into your right brain. You have to do all the analysis and then let it go.
I want to ask you about the upcoming workshop you have with Jody Gottlieb, who we've been talking about, but I need to ask, how do you do that? Because that's my Achilles heel. I was raised by two parents who were in the field of psychology. I am an over thinker, and it's, and I know that I'm not alone in this, where you approach copy, whether it's voiceover copy, commercial copy, or a script, where you can just get in your way. Like, how do you do the work with the left brain and then just shut it off? I mean, do you just say to yourself when you're going to do the scene, okay, done, I got it, and dive?
Well, isn't that what you do when you perform? You go, no, I know what I'm doing. I got it. You don't think about it, right? I got it. If you, one of the analogies I use is throwing a baseball. When you first learn how to throw a baseball, you are thinking about, okay, I got to hold it like this. I got to turn my shoulders. I got to put my arm back like this. And when I follow through, I have to get my weight going forward and extend my arm toward the target. Now, can you think of all that while you're throwing a ball?
Yeah, but I've never learned how to throw a ball correctly. Okay. So
you don't have to throw a ball really well. But when you pick up a ball and you throw it, are you thinking about anything?
No.
Just not where you're throwing it, right?
Right.
Well, here's the ball, here. And then you're looking at somebody, go, here's the ball. And all you're concentrating is on that person that you're throwing the ball to. That's what voiceover is. In my opinion, pick it up and throw it after you've done the analysis.
Tell me a little bit about the upcoming class that you have with Jody Gottlieb, creating VO characters for commercials.
Yeah, well, Jody wanted me to help with her our voiceover clinic. And the voiceover clinic is going to help people, help actors or non-actors or people who just want to get in the voiceover business that may have interesting voices but not know what to do with them or how to breathe, how to relax, understanding the copy, understanding your audience, things of this nature. Jody and I feel with her voiceover experience and my experience in show business,
sure.
I think we can make a really strong team for a very holistic way of getting into your voiceover career, whether you are already in the career or whether you're not in the career. Everybody could always use a little coaching and a little insight into what they're doing. So I thought this is a perfect opportunity for Jody and I, and Jody thought so too, for us to get together and make this happen. And I'm looking forward to it. Teaching my classes has been a great reminder and how wonderful it is to give back and to see this growth that I see in my students is just phenomenal. And just so proud of them and so happy that I can be there for them to make these revelations come through for them and to see that light in their eyes. It's just, you know.
Well, I'm excited about the workshop too. I should let folks know that it's February 5th and it's online. And you can email jody@jodygottliebvo.com to find out more. Bill, my last question for you is, Maya Angelou says, words mean more than what is set down on paper. It takes the human voice to infuse them with shades of deeper meaning. So with that said, what do you hope your voice conveys in work as well as in life?
Well, deeper meaning, indeed, deeper understanding, absolutely. And I hope everyone realizes that we all have a voice, and that voice is important, meaningful, and capable of change. And I hope that all our voices out there, whether we're speaking or writing or thinking, but human voice is an instrument that is unparalleled. It can do things, remarkable things, and it can convey emotion, need, want, desire, all the things that we imbue in our bodies, in our minds, and our souls come through our voice.
What a good guy. Thanks for listening in. Join me next week where I'll be exploring the question, is there a personal growth or spiritual component to our work as voiceover actors? Not only will I share my thoughts on this topic, but you'll hear from other industry notables. Until then, here's to owning our voices.